Well, it wasn't intended this way, but I think today on Issues Etc., for the large part, is going to be an apologetics day. That's one of the major tasks that we have here on Issues Etc. Defend the faith, teach the truth. That defense, an old-fashioned word for that defense, is an apology. To exercise a little apologetics. Now, all Christians do this, whether they admit it or not, whether they know it or not, they engage in apologetics. Whenever you meet a Mormon at the door and one of the elders wants to talk to you about Joseph Smith and you ask questions about the veracity of Joseph Smith, whether or not his visions were true, you are engaging in apologetics. You don't need a degree. You don't even need to call it that. It's a defense of the faith, and it's also a way of evaluating the truth claims of other religions as well. So Christian apologetics on the docket for today. A number of short conversations, beginning with Frank Turek. We're going to talk about the faith of atheism. He is co-author, along with Dr. Norman Geisler, of a new book titled, I Don't Have Enough Faith to Be an Atheist. He's vice president of Southern Evangelical Seminary. He'll join us here in just a moment. After that, we're going to talk about Mormonism and DNA, something you might want to bring up in the course of a conversation if you have one with a Mormon, and that is, does the DNA evidence support one of the basic historical claims of the Mormon faith that the 10 lost tribes of Israel are in fact among us as Native Americans? Those are other claims attached to that, but let's deal with the DNA evidence, Mormonism and DNA. Here in the, that'll be in the second part of this first hour of Issues, Etc. Bill McKeever of Mormonism Research Ministry will be our guest there. In the second hour of the program, we'll spend a little time of open lines. We hope to hear from someone with an update of what's going on in the United Methodist Church as they meet in Pittsburgh in a long session. They're every 4-year quadrennial meeting there. And of course, that's all in the news. And then we'll be talking with Dr. Gary Habermas about evidence for the resurrection of Jesus Christ. What we'll do there is kind of go through the basic, what we need to start with actually, is a basic course on how historians determine the factuality of historical claims, and then we'll go through some of the objections one by one with Dr. Gary Habermas of Liberty University there in the second hour of Issues, Etc. The final hour of the program, open lines for your questions and your comments. Several things to talk about. I do need to bring a few things to your attention, one of them being that the Roman Catholic Church has issued a statement from the Vatican about what they're calling abuses in the Mass. That is, that's their way of talking about people who are pretty much doing what the darn well please on Sunday morning in Roman Catholic churches. We'll find out what the Vatican has to say about that and some reaction to it, as well as your questions and comments, anything you want to talk about in the third hour of Issues, Etc. Our call-in numbers are 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. I'm Todd Wilkin. Frank Turek is our first guest. We're talking about the faith of atheism. He's vice president of Southern Evangelical Seminary, and I mentioned the book before called I Don't Have Enough Faith to Be an Atheist that he's co-authored with Dr. Norman Geisler. Frank, welcome back to Issues, Etc.
Todd, great to be with you.
Why do you two describe atheism as a faith?
Because there are two possibilities. Every worldview has faith, and the two possibilities are you either have a lot of evidence for your view, and therefore you only need a little bit of faith, or you don't have much evidence, and therefore you need a lot of faith. And when you look at the evidence for the existence of God and the fact that therefore miracles are possible, and you look at the evidence for the New Testament documents actually being true in the sense that they describe what actually happened 2,000 years ago, then you have to have a lot more faith to be an atheist than you do to be a Christian.
Let's begin by basically kind of drawing the line. Where is the line drawn between the atheist and the Christian? What is the essential issue that's at stake here?
Well, I think obviously God's existence is the essential issue. They don't believe that there's a being beyond the world who created the world and sustains the world. And of course, Christians, Muslims, and Jews believe there is. And we show rationally why it takes more faith to be an atheist than it does to be a Christian, because there's a lot of strong evidence, as you know out there, Todd, that this God who is beyond the world and sustains the world actually created the world and sustains it to this day.
In that connection, there is a theory that has come to the fore that is rather popular that doesn't necessarily claim the existence of a divine being, but it puts it in terms, and this is in the scientific community, of an intelligent designer. Tell us about that.
Well, yeah, the intelligent design movement has really taken hold recently thanks to the works of Philip Johnson and William Dembski and others. And basically, it just points to the fact that what we see in nature, not only in the universe, but also in life itself, points to a designer. Let me give you an example. Suppose you were to come down from your bedroom one morning, and you see on the kitchen table the cereal box is knocked over, the alphabet cereal box, and the letters on the placemat spell, "Take out the garbage, Mom." What are you going to assume? The cat knocked the box over? Earthquake shook the house? You're going to go, this is signs of an intelligent being. There's intelligence behind this. Mom obviously wants me to take out the garbage because those things don't happen randomly. Well, just like there's what we call specified complexity or information in the alphabet serial message, there's that same specified complexity in human life, in fact, in all life, in DNA. And if take out the garbage Mom requires an intelligent being, then thousands and thousands, even millions of volumes of this information, which is found in a cell, also requires an intelligent being.
So do you find it ironic, as previous guests on this program have pointed out, that there are scientists who would say no creator, it is all the product of particles in the void, bouncing around, knocking against each other, eventually coming together into some coherence we call life, and life eventually comes up with this crazy idea of a God that doesn't exist. Do you find it odd that the same scientists are very anxious to find signs of intelligence out in the universe?
Yeah, in fact, you're hitting on what we talk about in the book a little bit there, Todd. And many of your listeners, I'm sure, have seen the movie Contact, right?
Yeah.
And Jodie Foster, of course, just went nuts when she got that string of prime numbers from 1 up to 111 or whatever it was. And she said, this has to be from an intelligent being, because random radio waves are produced naturally, but not radio waves that have this type of pattern. And so she immediately knew it was the product of an intelligent life. Well, if just prime numbers between 1 and 111 require intelligence, then so do 1,000 volumes of an encyclopedia, which Darwinist Richard Dawkins admits is found in the cell, in the first one-celled creature. I mean, it just makes no sense to say that one happened randomly and the other happened by intelligence.
Why should anyone believe anything?
Well, that's the title of one of our books, or one of our chapters in our book, I Don't Have Enough Faith to Be an Atheist. I think that's chapter 2. Why should anyone believe anything at all? Because you have good rational reasons for believing something, not just because you find it comfortable, not just because your parents taught it to you, not just because the culture teaches it, but because it's true and you can use the laws of logic and the principles of induction to figure out what really is true.
So what position does the thoroughgoing atheist, not the casual guy who simply chooses not to think about God, I don't know they'd call themselves maybe the armchair atheist.
Sure.
But the thoroughgoing atheist who has really thought it through, and I've dealt with these people as you have as well,
right,
Frank, very intelligent people, sometimes in many respects painfully honest with themselves and about the world around them. Mm-hmm. What position does the thoroughgoing atheist find himself in a world that seems to have, by common sense, someone behind it?
Right. Well, when it comes to the beginning of the universe, which virtually all scientists agree occurred, the Big Bang, most scientists agree it happened, well, if you look at the beginning of the universe exploded into being out of nothing. It didn't explode into being out of existing particles. It exploded into being out of nothing, no thing. Aristotle had a good definition of what nothing was. He said, nothing is what rocks dream about. So suddenly there was nothing, and then bang, an entire universe exploded into being. Now you have two choices here, Todd. Either no one created something out of nothing, or someone created something out of nothing. Now, which view is more reasonable? We say someone. And, of course, then you always get the question, who made God? Well, there's two possibilities here. Since we exist, something has always existed, because you can't create yourself, right? So if something has always existed, either the universe always existed or something outside the universe always existed. All the evidence seems to indicate that the universe had a beginning. In other words, it has not always existed. It's not eternal. Therefore, there must be something outside the universe that has always existed, and that's exactly what we call God.
Okay, let's deal with that. The atheist says, yes, there is something that has always existed, and that is matter and energy.
That's not true.
Interchangeable.
That's not true, because matter and energy have not always existed. In fact, Einstein's general theory of relativity, which has been proven to be accurate to 5 decimal points, says that time, matter, and space are correlative. In other words, the universe had a beginning, and when it had a beginning, time itself came into existence. Matter itself came into existence. So you can't have time and matter without the other. They're all correlative. So when the Big Bang occurred, it literally occurred from nothing. It didn't occur from existing matter.
So I'm trying to think of this in terms of the way that the kids are taught this in elementary school. Maybe it's just so oversimplified that all of the matter of the universe was compressed into a point that an infinitesimally small point, a non-existent point. And then for some reason, it the Big Bang occurred. It expanded outward. You say that picture is not accurate of
what scientists call it a singularity, where they say it's a point of infinite density, but you can't have an infinitely dense, finite thing. That's a contradiction in terms. It's a category mistake. Most scientists agree that the universe exploded out of nothing, not a infinitely dense point of matter. Everything was pulled together into a point. They call it a singularity, but it doesn't really make sense when you think about an infinitely dense, finite thing.
Let's turn from the physical, then,
mm-hmm.
to something more metaphysical, and that is good and evil,
yeah.
The classical problem of evil. If God exists, and as most people who believe in a God, most theists would assume, he is omnipotent and, in some sense, all good, then why does evil exist? Why is the world so rotten?
Right. Well, we have an appendix in the book, I Don't Have Enough Faith to Be an Atheist. It's appendix number 1, where we say, if God, why evil? And we kind of have this interesting dialogue between a mock dialogue between a Christian and an atheist. And there's many things we point out there, but one of the things that we point out is that one of the reasons evil exists is because free will exists. And free will is necessary for there to be love, but it also allows the possibility that evil would exist. A lot of people say, well, I wish God would stop all the evil in the world. Of course, when they say that, they fail to consider the fact that if God were to do that, he may stop them. He may stop me. He may stop you, because we do evil as well. So if God were to stop all the evil, he would stop all the free choice. If he stopped all the free choice, then we wouldn't even have the opportunity to choose him or reject him. He wouldn't even have the opportunity for love.
Are there real atheists? I mean, the old saying, of course, is there are no atheists in foxholes.
Mm-hmm.
Basically played out is when life gets really hard,
mm-hmm.
everyone at the bottom line drops all the skepticism and the denial and is some form of a theist. Are there real atheists?
I don't know. I would have to say that I find it pretty amusing that the atheists I've run into seem to be pretty militant. And I always ask them, if there is no God, why are you spending all the time fighting him? You know, it just seems to be what you're doing. And as we point out in the book, very often atheism is not really a matter of the mind. It's more a matter of the will. They simply don't want there to be a God, because if there is a God, then they are no longer in charge. They no longer have control over their own lives. They no longer can do what they want. And we document a number of famous atheists who've said things like that. I didn't want there to be a God.
Okay, back to the nexus between the physical and the metaphysical.
Mm-hmm.
Miracles.
Mm-hmm.
An atheist is going to say, look, in the world as it is structured according to natural causes, miracles are ruled out of order from the very beginning, out of hand, because there are no natural explanations for such events.
Which is exactly, that begs the question. Of course there are no natural explanations, because miracles are not natural events. That's the whole point. But if Genesis 1:1 is true, if it is true that the universe exploded into being out of nothing, then every other verse in the Bible is easy to believe. Doesn't mean every other verse in the Bible is true, but every other verse in the Bible is believable. Because if there is a being outside the world who created the world out of nothing, and by the way, when he created it, he tweaked it precisely so life could exist here on Earth. If there is a God who did that, can he make axe heads float in water? Can he part the Red Sea? Can he raise somebody from the dead? Of course. If he can create the universe out of nothing, he can do anything else he wants in this universe.
We're talking with Frank Turek. He's vice president of Southern Evangelical Seminary, co-author with Dr. Norman Geisler of a new book titled I Don't Have Enough Faith to Be an Atheist, and we're talking about the faith of atheism. Our call-in numbers are 505-7850. or 1-800-730-2727. Okay, so the atheist responds, fine, the events did occur, and they do have natural explanations, but what Christians and the like do is simply misinterpret the event and put God into the equation, whereas if they were a little more reasonable, they would just find a natural explanation for what occurred.
Yeah, that's called God of the gaps, and Christians have been guilty of doing that, by the way. They have said, you know, lightning caused directly by God. We later figured out it wasn't. But let me ask you a question. When you go to Mount Rushmore and you see the faces on the side of the mountain, is it considered God of the gaps if you say, well, I think an intelligent being did that, or should you continue to look for a natural cause of the faces on Mount Rushmore? No, there's a point where you say, look, I got enough evidence. This is obviously a intelligent being who did this. Take out the garbage mom on my placemat is obviously the work of an intelligent being. You see, Todd, it's not just that we lack evidence for a natural explanation. It's that we have positive evidence that there's intelligence behind the universe, that there's intelligence behind life, that there's intelligence behind Mount Rushmore, that there's intelligence behind Take Out the Garbage Mom.
Now let's talk about where this atheism has found its way into the pale of the visible church. And you have an appendix on this late in the book on the Jesus Seminar, and we've seen a lot of this played out in the popular media lately. Peter Jennings has done several specials
right.
on Jesus, and then Jesus and Paul. There's all sorts of websites where you can find the conclusions that theologians, or so self-proclaimed theologians, are making about the veracity of biblical texts. Tell us about the Jesus Seminar and whether or not it actually speaks for Jesus.
Actually, they don't. They don't speak for Jesus at all, because most of the people on the Jesus Seminar are liberal in their theology. Many are even atheists. And one of the main players in there is a guy by the name of John Dominic Crossan, who we point out in the book has admitted that he has a presupposition against miracles. In other words, he doesn't believe miracles can occur. So when he looks at the New Testament and he sees all the miracles in it, he goes, well, I can't believe that. Jesus didn't do this. Jesus didn't say this, because I don't believe in miracles. Well, if you go to the text saying, I don't believe in miracles, doesn't matter how long you look at it, you're always going to come to the same conclusion. Jesus didn't do this. Jesus didn't say this. So it's no surprise that when the Jesus Seminar looks at the New Testament, they come to the wrong conclusions, that the New Testament, they say, is, you know, only 18% can be attributed to Jesus. That's just not true. You look at the evidence, and the evidence we point out in several chapters in the book, I Don't Have Enough Faith to Be an Atheist, and you'll see that this is eyewitness testimony, and Jesus actually did and said these things that he is supposed to have said and done.
But Frank, I mean, I see the name underneath the picture on television. The guy's a scholar. He's got numbers behind, letters and numbers behind his name. Obviously, he's gone to some school. How do they draw their conclusions about what they would conclude the unreliability of the New Testament?
Well, one of the things they do is they take the later Gnostic Gospels, the Gospels that were written in the 2nd century, much like this guy Dan Brown has taken with the Da Vinci Code, and he's making those Gospels more superior to the Gospels which were written a century earlier. It would be like somebody today writing a distorted view of the Civil War and saying this is really what happened, rather than the accounts of the eyewitnesses who wrote down exactly what did happen in the Civil War. It would be like us taking somebody today who distorts it and saying this is really what happened. Well, no, that's not really what happened. We have eyewitnesses who were there and actually saw it and then later died for it. And we should take their testimony as the testimony of authenticity, not testimony that comes a century or two later, as the Jesus Seminar people take.
Okay, we've talked about the physical, the metaphysical, the interaction between two in the realm of miracles in the Jesus Seminar.
Mm-hmm.
Finally, the moral. The atheist says, look, I have a basis for my morality that does not require a God outside this universe.
I would say, what is that basis? Because if there is no God, then everything's a matter of opinion. If there's no God whose very nature defines what is right and what is wrong, then it's just two people's opinions against one another. It's just Mother Teresa's opinion against Hitler's opinion. Who's to say that Hitler was wrong and Mother Teresa was right, unless there's some standard beyond both of them by which we can define what is right?
Well, maybe the atheist might respond, look, Yes, morality is nothing more than a human convention, but it's a convention that keeps the majority of people alive and helps us recognize the dangerous ones out there. There's no need for this to be objective. It can be subjective and still be quite useful to us.
Well, it depends on what you mean, but once again, by useful, what does useful mean? You're implying there's a standard beyond you. Useful in the sense of Hitler or useful in the sense of Mother Teresa? By whose standard? See, you're still the atheist is still begging the question as to what is useful, what is good, what is beneficial. Ironically, this whole utilitarian viewpoint that you just do whatever gives the greatest good begs the question as to what is the greatest good? Where do you get the standard of good from? And so the atheists who try and say convention is really what morality is all about. In fact, I talked to an atheist on the radio the other day, and he was saying, "Oh, it's just all convention." I said, "Well, in Nazi Germany, they had the convention that they ought to kill Jews. Did that make it right then?" He said, "I don't want to talk about Germany." Well, what do you mean you don't want to talk about Germany? It really happened. You know, you're still assuming there's a standard beyond you, and that standard is the very nature of God. Now, atheists can say they believe in morality. They just have no way of justifying it. In fact, atheists do believe in morality. It's written on their hearts. It's written on everybody's heart. They intuitively know it's wrong to murder. But where do they get that idea from? Why does everybody intuitively know that? Because God has put it on the heart. He's prescribed it. If there is a prescription on the hearts of all human beings, there must be a prescriber who put it there. Jefferson knew that. That's why he said, "We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, endowed by their Creator with certain inalienable rights, among them life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness."
Frank Turek, thank you very much. Excellent book. Thank you for your work and for being our guest on Issues, Etc.
Todd, sounds like a great show. Let's do it again.
Yes. Frank Turek is Vice President of Southern Evangelical Seminary and author along with Dr. Norman Geisler, of the book called "I Don't Have Enough Faith to Be an Atheist." A simple way to think about this, folks, think about it in terms of the man behind the curtain, whether it be creation, the world that we live in every day. The simple question is, what stands behind this? Is it a God that has designed it, created it, oversees it, sustains it, given it order? Or let's not talk about creation. Let's talk about morality. What stands behind the rules that you live by, that you hold near and dear? Why you feed your infant son rather than strangle him in his sleep? What stands behind that rule? You can ask that of an atheist or an agnostic, or anyone for that matter, any skeptic. Does it simply your desire to keep your son alive? And so if the guy in the house next to you doesn't have that desire and strangles his infant son in his sleep, who are you to gainsay the choice he's made there? What stands behind all of it? That's a question that atheists will continue to struggle with, because God ain't going away. He's here to stay, and he's left his fingerprints all over us and all over the created world, his creation, and we his creatures. When we come back from this break, we're going to spend the second half of this first hour talking with Bill McKeever. Mormons claim, as part of the historical claims of their faith, that the Native Americans are, in fact, the 10 lost tribes of Israel. We'll see whether the DNA evidence supports that after this.
Defending life from beginning to end. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
What does it mean to be a Lutheran? Well, being a Lutheran is truly all about Jesus. The central teachings of the Lutheran faith are the central teachings of Holy Scripture. Jesus is always and only the center of all Christian teaching. Being a Lutheran is truly all about Jesus, because Holy Scripture is truly all about Jesus. Hi, I'm Todd Wilkin. Our Issues, Etc. book of the month for May is called "Why I Am a Lutheran, Jesus at the Center," by regular guest Daniel Preuss. You can order "Why I Am a Lutheran" by calling Concordia Publishing House weekdays during regular business hours, 1-800-325-3040. Or browse before you buy at our website, issuesetc.org. Click on the What's New section. There you'll find information on our Issues, Etc. book of the month for May, "Why I Am a Lutheran, Jesus at the Center," by Daniel Preuss.
Get ready to pray that more Christian books will be published in India. This Global Minute highlights Christians in India who are producing gospel-centered books and media. Vishal Mangalwadi is a leading apologist from India who's helping a group of 25 Christians begin publishing in various languages spoken around the country.
Hopefully we want to get to a point where we can mobilize up to 1,000 mobile bookshops to fill the whole nation with Christian literature. And once you have the literature, we can turn it into audio books and videos.
The project is called Reforming the Soul of India, and a book the group has published deals with the national debate on conversion to Christianity in India. Vishal is also working in North America and Western Europe to show that the Bible is the most important book ever produced in the West. Pray for India. Get updates on gospel breakthroughs around the world by visiting the website missionvisionnetwork.org.
Welcome to the Meyer Minute. Everyone touring the New Jersey prison was a professional. But when Joyce Carol Oates made the mistake of smiling at some male inmates, the whole cell block leered at her. This professional was reduced to a physical object. Some women aspire to marriage, but many a married woman is not content to be identified as wife or mother and wants to be known as a professional person. In a male-dominated society, men don't have that problem to the same degree, but only adult doesn't get it that men identify themselves by what they do. It's who you are, not what you do. That, I think, is no answer. It highlights the problem. Who am I? Again, it's not who you are, but whose you are. Still not satisfying. Couch potato justifies his life by saying, "I'm a baptized child of God." Time marches on, and we see our roles in life changing. Especially as a Christian, I don't really know who I am. It has not yet been revealed what we shall be. 1 John 3:2. Jesus, the grand identity robber, deny yourself and follow me. Unbelievably radical. Almost unbelievable.
All the plans are made for your upcoming big event. The I's are dotted, the T's are crossed, but how do you let those outside your congregation know about it? The answer is the AM 850 KFUO Datebook. Just send us your information to KFUO Datebook, 85 Founders Lane, St. Louis, Missouri, 63105. We'll mention your event at random during our Datebook announcement twice daily on AM 850 KFUO. Again, send your information to Datebook, KFUO Radio, 85 Founders Lane, St. Louis, Missouri, 63105.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. Bill McKeever joins us for the remainder of this hour. He's a regular guest here on Issues Etc. As I said, today a bit of apologetics and then some open lines tacked on at the end for your questions and your comments. We talked in the last hour about the faith of atheists. What about the faith of Mormons and the single claim? It's not the only claim they make, but the single claim that they have made that the Native Americans that inhabited North and South America are in fact the descendants of the lost tribes of Israel. They are, in fact, Jews. And then, of course, there are all sorts of other claims attached to that. Now that we have the ability to test such claims scientifically through DNA, how do those claims stand up? We're going to talk about that for the next 25 minutes of Issues Etc. Bill McKeever is director of Mormonism Research Ministry based in Draper, Utah. He's co-author of the books Mormonism 101 and Answering Mormons' Questions. He's also written an article in the latest edition of the Christian Research Journal titled DNA Science Challenges LDS History. Bill, welcome back.
Hey, it's good to be back. How are things going?
Very well. And for you?
Oh, it's been hectic. We made the move up here to Utah, and I'm still looking forward to getting my office finished so I can unpack my books.
If you're anything like me, you feel a little naked if your books are still in
boxes.
Oh,
let me tell you, it's awful. It's a terrible feeling.
I know I have this someplace, but it's packed away, yeah.
You know, I can't even find my copy of the Book of Mormon. That's how lost I am up here, you know. took off for a meeting back east and didn't even have it with me.
You shouldn't have trouble coming across a Book of Mormon up there, should you? Hand them out on the street corners?
I'm sure all my neighbors have them, and I have them too, but I just need to find which box they're in. That's the problem.
All right, then we'll ask you to work from memory.
We can do that.
What is the basic claim about Native Americans and early Mormonism, their claims about what took place in America so many centuries ago?
Well, ever since the beginning of Mormonism, they have always held to this position that Lehi, one of the principal characters in the Book of Mormon, was a prophet of God who was of the tribe of Manasseh, who came to the Western Hemisphere with his family. And as the Book of Mormon story goes, the family kind of broke up into two warring factions known as the Nephites and Lamanites, which get their name from two principal sons of Lehi, Nephi and Laman. According to the Mormon story, the Nephites were of a light-skinned complexion, and the Lamanites, because of their wickedness, were given a dark-skinned complexion. And we all basically know that up until 1978, skin color did have some kind of say as to what the spiritual condition of an individual was. This all changed in 1978 with the priesthood revelation, as they call it, allowing all worthy male members to hold the priesthood regardless of skin color. But nonetheless, the way the story goes is that the dark-skinned Lamanites wiped out the light-skinned Nephites, and Mormons have been told by their leaders, by Joseph Smith, that the ancestors of the American Indian were, in fact, these ancient Lamanites. Now, that connection with, of course, Lehi would mean that the Native Americans would have Semitic blood or Jewish blood. And that is the problem now with all this recent DNA genetic research that's been done. They find that there is no genetic connection between the Semitic people and the American Indian people. And this is causing quite a dilemma because it's difficult to find a Mormon leader who has not made this connection. And yet, that's the way the science stands right now.
How integral is this claim? And it's just basically an historic claim that now can be verified or disproven by science. How integral is it to Mormon teaching?
Well, it is very, very important and very integral. It's foundational. I mean, if there is no connection between the Indian people and the Jews, it undermines the entire Book of Mormon narrative and, of course, places a lot of suspicion on Joseph Smith himself as being a prophet of God, the one who founded the Mormon movement. So it raises a lot of questions regarding his veracity, and it also raises a lot of questions regarding the authenticity of the Book of Mormon as being an ancient document rather than just a 19th century novel. So it is very significant, and it's causing quite a bit of problems with a lot of Mormons. Thinking Mormons who have heard this all their lives and are now reading these reports coming from geneticists who really have no bias against Mormonism. They're just scientists, and they're wondering what's going on here. And the Mormons are sticking to their story. They're still insisting that, of course, the story in the Book of Mormon is true, which they have to do. They can't back off of that. But what's interesting is that a lot of their apologists are now spinning it in such a way as to say, for instance, I was just reading on one Mormon apologist website. In fact, I think it was one of them that I quoted actually in the article in the CRI Journal, is it's not the Book of Mormon that is really wrong, it's that the Mormon leadership has interpreted it wrong and have been saying things that are inaccurate, and that's where the problem is. And I'm thinking, that's very typical of how the Mormon apologist has to work. They often have to diss the leadership in order to make their Mormonism seem a little more palatable in light of historical finds and scientific evidence.
But doesn't solve the problem entirely, because am I correct that at least what I have heard is that the Mormon leadership, when they've made some of these pronouncements, some of these men who've made these pronouncements have been prophets.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
And they're not supposed to misinterpret or be able to misinterpret these things.
That is a major problem, Todd, because Mormons have been told to believe that God will not allow the living prophet of the church to lead the church astray. This has been echoed by numerous Mormon leaders. And here is the dilemma. We have, all through their entire history, these Mormon leaders saying the same thing, that these American Indians, they're descendants of the Lamanites mentioned in the Book of Mormon, and now the evidence doesn't support the folklore, if you will. And it does raise a problem because it undermines that very principle as well. And so we're finding that they can, in fact, have some problems.
Tell us about the science that has been brought to bear upon the claims that of Mormonism, that early Americans are the descendants of at least a strand of Jewish blood.
Well, as far as the science that has been has disproven that theory,
yes.
Or well,
what did they do? How did they go about testing this theory?
Well, there have been a number of geneticists who, of course, been tracing man's ancestry. And it was kind of born out of this, as well as there was a philanthropist, a Mormon philanthropist by the name of Sorensen, and he put up a lot of money to do a lot of DNA testing, too, among different people groups. And this came up several years ago, and one of the things that people raised as far as a question is, well, what if this was to disprove the Book of Mormon? And Sorensen, I believe it was, actually made the comment that he wasn't doing this project and testing the blood of different people to prove or disprove the Mormon, but he said he would allow the chips to fall as they may. And here's what's happened. In the meantime, other geneticists, of course, have been doing this kind of work, and they were coming up with the same conclusions, that there is no relationship between the Semitic people and the American Indian. And I'm not a geneticist by any stretch of the imagination, but what little I've learned of this and studying this, it's just fascinating about the mitochondrial DNA and the different groups and things like that. And I started looking at this probably back in 1997. This is when I started really getting into this pretty deep. And I kind of sat on it for a long time because there wasn't a whole lot out at that time that I could get a hold of. And then in these past 2, 3, maybe 4 years, it seems to have been coming to the surface and is really coming out to the general public, primarily through this Mormon by the name of Thomas Murphy, who I quote extensively in the article. Murphy is LDS. He's a Mormon of record. He admits that he's not a very good Mormon and that he doesn't go to church regularly or anything like that. But nonetheless, he has a tradition in Mormonism, and he is the one that has been coming out with this information and speaking quite regularly on the subject and, of course, irritating a lot of Mormon apologists. And Murphy has taken a lot of heat from even his own people. They've accused him of, collaborating with apostates and acting like an anti-Mormon. And basically all he's doing is saying, look, the science doesn't match up to what we've been told by our leadership. The science, he believes, is right, and what the leaders have been saying is wrong. That's all he's been saying. And, of course, that's a pretty tough, decision for a Mormon to make. And you can imagine why a lot of them might be getting a little upset with him. But he's only telling what, he's learned, to be true.
Bill McKeever is our guest. We're talking about Mormonism's historical claims and DNA evidence. He's director of Mormonism Research Ministry based in Draper, Utah, co-author of the books Mormonism 101 and Answering Mormons' Questions. And he's written this article in the latest edition of the Christian Research Journal titled DNA Science Challenges LDS History. Our call-in number is 505-7850. 1-800-730-2727. Now, there's another case that has been made for quite some time as well, and that is the archaeological case, testing whether or not one can find evidence of essentially Jewish settlement in early America. How does that evidence shake out?
Well, it still hasn't come up with anything. In all the years that the Mormons have been trying to find the evidence in the New World to support their theory of the Book of Mormon, nothing's been coming up. Of course, what's really interesting about that whole dilemma is the different theories even within the Mormon Church. When you look at the early leadership of Mormonism, Joseph Smith, Oliver Cowdery, people like that in the early years, they had basically the theory that all these Nephites and Lamanites lived in upstate New York because that's where Joseph Smith allegedly found the gold plates that contained the Book of Mormon record. However, later on, that theory was abandoned pretty much by the scholars in Mormonism for what we call now the limited Tehuantepec theory, or the Central America theory, that the people of the Nephites and Lamanites actually lived down in Central America and didn't live in New York at all. There's a lot of geographical problems with both theories, but nonetheless, most of the scholars seem to stick more closely with the Central America theory. But again, they're not really finding evidence that really makes a slam dunk for their case. In fact, a lot of archaeologists and anthropologists that are non-Mormon have kind of scoffed at even such a notion that these people lived during that time period. So the Mormons, again, are pretty much by themselves in this idea. But as of yet, if you were to go to Salt Lake City, if you were to just go 20 minutes from my home, go downtown and go into the Museum of History and Art across the street from Temple Square and ask for their section in the museum where they carry the Nephite artifacts, they won't have a section for it. There's none there. They don't have one. In fact, I've done that before. I asked down there once years ago just for fun, and the curator looked at me and smiled and said, "There aren't any." And so he was pretty good about it. But again, the Mormons, you have to understand, though, the Mormons don't believe the Book of Mormon because of archaeological evidence or any tangible evidence that show its message to be true. They believe the Book of Mormon to be true based on a feeling that they all share. This feeling is, of course, is a result of prayer, they believe, to their God, and that their Holy Ghost confirmed the witness of the Book of Mormon to them. So, with many Latter-day Saints, trying to convince them of the error of the Book of Mormon with evidence might not even work, because a lot of Mormons don't listen to evidence. They go by this subjective feeling, this burning in the bosom, as they call it.
Well, oftentimes when we do an hour on Mormonism, we talk with you in this short form or other guests on the issue of Mormonism and its various claims. I will get an email from someone, and usually the email begins, I'm a Mormon, I'm LDS. Mm-hmm. And I listened with interest to your hour, to your guest. Often they'll say, guest misrepresented what we believe. But I have a testimony.
Yeah.
I have a testimony. Is that what you're talking about here?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I hear it all the time. I just got an email from a missionary that I met while he was on his mission where I used to live in California. And it's the same old thing. You always get it wrong. You never get it right. Even though I'm quoting their own leaders on this subject, It's really bizarre about that, Todd, because no one who ever is critical of Mormonism ever gets it right. Nobody seems to understand what true Mormonism is. And my rebuttal to that is, if Mormonism is that esoteric, it certainly cannot be Christian, because Christianity is not that hard. It's not that difficult. But yet, that is a common argument that I hear a lot. They will often say, well, forget the evidence, just pray about it. In fact, I had a missionary call from Provo 1 year after I had gone to the Temple Square years ago and signed the guest book. And they called my house, and this young guy was talking to me, a pleasant guy, and asked me, if I had ever read the Book of Mormon. I told him I had. He says, well, what'd you think about it? And I says, well, have you got a minute? And he said, yeah. So for the next few minutes, I very quickly encapsulated some of the problems I had with the Book of Mormon, and this was his response. He says, well, given all that, Mr. McKeever, have you ever thought of just setting that aside and just praying about it? And you see, that's my problem. I tried to explain to him that prayer was never meant to erase factual data. It was never meant for that. And that to pray along those lines is really, it's a sacrilege as far as I'm concerned, because I take prayer very seriously. What's funny, though, is that when you tell the Mormon that you really don't see the biblical necessity of praying about the Book of Mormon, they will accuse you of not taking prayer seriously. So you can see how we're coming at this from two entirely different approaches here. So that is a dilemma, no doubt.
Joseph Smith was not unique in his belief. Other people did believe at the time. They were all wondering, where did these Native American people come from?
Yes, you're
so
right.
So it was in a sense, Joseph Smith simply perpetuating kind of common theories about the origin of Native American people?
Yeah, the Book of Mormon is not entirely unique in these theories. Of course, they give it a Jewish spin, whereas some of the theories of the day were that they were ancient Romans that could have come over. But there were books written on the subject that do have a similar theme, View of the Hebrews for one. There was a Spalding manuscript which had a similar theme, and there seems to be evidence that's plausible to show that Smith could have very well had access to these sources and merely copied those ideas and put them into his manuscript as well. So, yeah, he's not entirely unique. Most people now looking at the Book of Mormon, not knowing of these other works, would think that he probably was, but he wasn't at all.
Okay, he's the first prophet. What about the most current LDS president and prophet, Gordon Hinckley? What does he say on the issue? Has he said anything on the issue of Lamanites, of Nephites?
Absolutely. In fact, when Gordon Hinckley has gone to various dedications of Mormon temples, especially, and I should say primarily the ones in Central America, because that's where this issue would really come up, he has stated more than once that the people in the crowd were actually descendants of Lehi. For instance, when he was giving the dedicatory prayer I've got the date here, 1983 in Mexico City, I'm quoting it here. He says, "Bless thy saints in this great land and those from other lands who will use this temple. Most have in their veins the blood of Father Lehi." So here again, he's making this connection. In Guatemala City, he did it again. "Thou kind and gracious Father, our hearts swell with gratitude for thy remembrance of the sons and daughters of Lehi. We thank thee, O God, for lifting the scales of darkness, which for generations clouded the vision of the descendants of Lehi." So here, Gordon Hinckley, the modern leader of the Mormon Church, is making this Lamanite-ish connection between the Indians and, of course, the Jews mentioned in the Book of Mormon.
Let's contrast this in the few minutes left to us here, Bill. There's, and this is being noticed all around, an effort on the part of at least the Utah Mormons, the LDS Church, to try and portray itself as mainstream Christian, or at least give that impression. How do you square these two?
Well, the problem, of course, is that when you look at the basic teachings of the Mormon Church, they have really not changed over the years. What has changed is how the Mormon Church is packaging themselves. They certainly are emphasizing the fact that they are a Christian church and that they should be recognized as Christian just as anybody else who claims to be Christian. The problem, of course, is when we look at these fundamental teachings of the LDS Church, we still find the same differences that have separated us since the church was founded back in 1830. They still believe that God was once a man who became God at a particular point in time. They still strongly believe in a works righteousness. They still use the temple ceremony as their gateway into the celestial kingdom. And, of course, when we look at these things carefully from a biblical worldview, we find that there are some significant problems with these things, so much so that it would be wrong for us to just turn the other way and embrace Mormonism as Christian just because some Mormons happen to be nice people. And unfortunately, that's what we're seeing a lot. I guess one of my pet peeves is that a lot of Christians nowadays, because they're more into the feelings aspect of Christianity, they've almost gone the way of the Mormon Church with these feelings things. They're forgetting their doctrine and the doctrine that makes us what we are, and they're just embracing Mormonism as being okay only because they happen to have nice Mormon neighbors. Well, I have nice Mormon neighbors too, you know, but that doesn't necessarily mean that something is Christian. And I my prayer is that Christians would be a little more discerning when they're talking with their Mormon friends and ask them some of these questions that would bring out some of these differences that we can really talk about and really discuss, because they are very serious issues here.
Is the average Mormon taught what we've been discussing here, that Native Americans are descendants of ancient Israel? And does the average Mormon still believe this?
Most of the ones that I've talked to do. They absolutely do. When I bring this up, they have no problem making that connection. It would be difficult for them not to, based on the title page of the Book of Mormon, which makes that connection. The title page of the Book of Mormon is supposed to be just as authentic and sacred as the rest of the Book of Mormon. It was part of the gold plates, according to what Joseph Smith said. So, yes, the ones that I've talked to, they do make that connection.
Is this why when the elders come to the door, they will often open to that first page of the Book of Mormon and ask you to quietly listen while they read that title page and the claims about Joseph Smith?
It could be that. It could be also the part in there that talks about Moroni 10:4-5, that if you will, you know, read this book and pray about this message, you know, the Holy Ghost will manifest its truthfulness to you. That's probably the main thing they're going after. They're trying to get you to get to the part where, regardless of what evidence you may have come up with or read that may show the Book of Mormon in a bad light, neglect all that and merely pray about it and get this feeling. But yet at the same time, when I ask Latter-day Saints, I say, listen, you do not believe in the Trinity, but you do believe in that in your Godhead you have three gods that are in complete agreement. And they always say yes, which, of course, in theology, that's tritheism, which is just as unbiblical as polytheism and anything that the Mormons could come up with. But nonetheless, if you believe that these three are in total agreement, then why should I believe that when you tell me the Holy Ghost confirmed what's in the Book of Mormon as being from God, and yet those things that you are saying that he confirmed contradict what God has revealed in the Bible, how can I even agree with that? You can't say that they're in total agreement, say the Holy Ghost told you that the Book of Mormon was true, when the Book of Mormon teaches things contrary to what God has already revealed in the Bible. It doesn't work that way. And I think these are some of the approaches that we need to use with our Mormon friends to get them to see that there is not a consistency here that is really necessary if we're going to embrace this religion as being true.
With only 1 minute before we have to go, Bill, what in fact is the Book of Mormon?
In my personal opinion, having studied it, it is nothing more than a 19th century novel that was concocted by Joseph Smith. I don't believe it has any supernatural givings to it whatsoever. It's merely a story that was pretty much understood by a lot of people during that time period. But what makes it unique is that Joseph Smith interspersed in his story a lot of King James Bible to make it sound very Christian. But nonetheless, even though it may contain portions of our Bible, it does not necessarily mean that it is ancient scripture. And that is, of course, the claim that the Mormons make for the book. In my opinion, it's just nothing more than a 19th century novel. As Mark Twain put it, it's really chloroform in print. It's not a very interesting book to most people. Of course, Mormons would say it is, but most non-Mormons reading it would not find it all that exciting or interesting. In fact, they might find it pretty much bland. It's basically a story of a group of people that just keep warring against each other, having all these fights and arguments, and then killing off one of the groups at the end of the story. But of course, that's my personal opinion. I know a Mormon would never agree with that, but nonetheless, that's the way I see it.
Bill McKeever, thanks again for being our guest.
It was my pleasure.
Bill McKeever is director of Mormon Research Ministry based in Draper, Utah. You can check out their website, www.mrm.org. MRM.org, or you can call them at their new office in Utah, area code 801-572-2153. That's 801 area code 572-2153. He's co-author of the books Mormonism 101 and Answering Mormons' Questions. By the way, that book, Mormonism 101, I've given it away to Mormons on more than one occasion. It's very useful. He's also written that article in the latest edition of the Christian Research Journal titled DNA Science Challenges LDS History. When we come back, a live report from Pittsburgh, where the United Methodist Church is holding its general conference.
Listen weekday afternoons to Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is critical for Issues Etc. to continue. Our address is Post Office Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri 63117. Or you can contact us via our website at www.issuesetc.org. That's www.issuesetc.org. For a cassette copy of the program, call 1-800-737-0172. That's 1-800-737-0172. Opinions expressed are not necessarily those of this station or the Jubilee Network. Issues Etc. is a broadcast service of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod.